This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is Rolling Stone, reading from the July and August 2025 edition, and we turn to random notes first. Bigger than ever, Amari rising. The Chilean American star has her eye on America. When you meet Amari, it's hard not to notice how much deeper her speaking voice is compared with the sweet falsetto she constantly deploys in her music. It's all intentional. There's a sensitivity and a vulnerability that I get to tap into my music that isn't very easy for me to express. She tells me under the shade of a tea house at the Japanese Garden outside of Los Angeles. Deep down, I'm a sensitive and mushy person. Emma Ray has been thinking a lot about who she really is. She's currently hard at work on Black Star, her upcoming third album, which she sees diving deeper into identity as both a woman and an artist. The album title is a triple entendre, referencing herself, the Ghanaian flag, and the Black cultural roots of the dance music she blends in the record. For the 30-year-old musician, whose real name is Ama Jenfi, there's been a power to finding herself and allowing herself to be vulnerable as an artist, which has given her strength. She says, there's a switch that flips. There's a confidence and big dick energy to it. It's a version of me that takes over. Black Star, her album, arrives 2 years after Emma Ray released her critically acclaimed LP, Fountain Baby, which featured the avant-garde alt-afro-pop hit Angels in Tibet, and follows a string of high-profile moments that have cemented her as an artist. Over the past couple of years, she opened for Kay Tronda and Sabrina Carpenter, corroborated several times across Childish Gambino's Bando Stone in the New World, and she made history as the first Ghanaian solo female act to perform at Coachella. She says it was a huge turning point because before my shows would mainly be like young Black kids, young African kids. There's clearly been a shift here. She goes on to say, now it's much more of a global representation and melting point, which brings me a huge sense of pride. She's seen her fan base expand, stretching out to include megastars. When she first heard she landed the tour slot with Sabrina Carpenter, for example, Amma Ray was skeptical. I was like, what the hell do Sabrina Carpenter know about some motherfucking Amma Ray? But Carpenter later told her she and her friends played her music all the time. She's a freak just like me, Amma Ray says. It's just a different kind of expression. Hers is bright and colorful. Mine is dark and edgy. But we're both saying the same thing. We're sexual beings, and we are women who feel free and confident in that. That no-holds-barred sexual freedom has defined a lot of Amma Ray's lyricism in the past. A sample lyric, I like my coffee with some head in the morning, from her song, Disguise. Her liberated approach continues on the new album. She says, Black Star to me is the genesis of me feeling sure and confident in myself as a grown woman, number one, and knowing exactly what my message is, how I want to tell it to the world. Part of her process also meant weaving threads from African sounds and the Black origins of dance music. She says, I'm taking my culture and I'm synthesizing it in a way that feels unique and fresh to me. I wanted to take a genre that needs to go back home to its roots and merge that with my African roots and hip-hop and create a new world. This album, she explains, took shape as she began to feel more embraced by the people in Ghana, many of whom misunderstood or preconceived notions about her and her family. Amma Ray was born in the Bronx, but grew up between the United States and Ghana with parents in high-profile roles in Ghana. Her father was a politician and banking executive, and her mother was the first female chairperson of Access Bank Ghana. She says many people assumed she was just a privileged kid making music. She says they didn't think I had anything to offer because they didn't feel like I could speak from the perspective of the everyday man. She understands why people may have thought that way, but notes that she doesn't really have much of a relationship with her father, and that her mother has worked her ass off for years to give my brother and me a good life. She explains, I don't need to apologize for that. However, she does feel like things have shifted. With this album, I want to stamp it is I'm from Ghana, I love being Ghanaian. I want to be a global symbol. Most of all, with Black Star, Amare says she wanted to have fun. For a fountain baby, the singer says she took things too seriously and allowed for too many cooks in the kitchen to decide how the album ended up sounding. This time around, the musician and her go-to producer, Kaya Steed, took the driver's seat for the project and traveled to Brazil to meet with several Baile Funk producers. She also worked with El Guincho and Blanks, who introduced more alternative, free-flowing sounds. They make music not for money or hits, but the expression, she says, and that is so beautiful. I wanted to feel like that. Amaru is ready to move past some of the harder moments that inspired Fountain Baby. It's a timestamp of a very specific time that felt like hell on earth, she says. She won't go into details about what it looked like, but explains that the music from that period equipped me with a lot of knowledge that I have today to navigate the world. She approached collaboration this time with a fresh mindset, shaped in part by her experience on Childish Gambino's Bando Stone album, where she embodied a character that Donald Glover, she says, pulled out of her. He's really good at getting an interesting performance out of you. Half the time I didn't realize that's what he was doing, but it was masterful, she says. Now when I bring other people into my world, I'm more intentional. They all have to operate as characters in this world. The new era kicks off with SMO, or Shut Me Out, which hears her asking a lover to scream and shout in bed over a retro futuristic dance energy that's ready for a boiler room DJ set. One of her favorite tracks, Star Killer, where she chants ketamine, coke, and Molly over a hypnotic rhythm. It's bold and audacious, she says. All the suits have gone back and forth like, I think you should change the name or the lyrics. But when I preview, people come to me and say, this is a record. I think it's just nice sometimes to say the thing as it is. The goal now with Black Star, global takeover, Amareya says bluntly. My soul can't rest until I feel like I've made a project that resonates in a really huge way globally. The last frontier is to make both a commercial and critical set. Above all, she adds, I'm a black fucking star. Also in random notes, hail to the Chiefs. The best new candidate for president, 4 college kids. Soon-to-be graduates are banding together to beat Trump as he runs for a third term. Here's their platform. By Avery G.D. Pratt, Charlotte Y. Livy, Hamza T. Massoud, and Sterling E. Hoyt, all contributors to the Harvard Lampoon. As college students on the cusp of graduation, we face an uncertain future. Gazing into the abyss of postgraduate life, we can't help but ask, what's the fastest track to success? Med school plus residency would take 8 years, becoming a CEO 9 years. Even the failed actor to barista pipeline is 6 years. But there's one job that's available to every American, a job that you can get in one day with no interview, the presidency. We know that the president technically needs to be 35 years of age. But to that we say, what does 22 plus 22 plus 22 plus 22 equal? Surely it's over the age 35. Historically, the president has never been 4 separate people. But think about how much the president has to do on a daily basis. Shaking hands, kissing babies, shaking babies. Just 1/4 of the job is a lot of responsibility. Congress has allocated only $400,000 for the presidential salary, but $100,000 isn't bad for your first job out of college. Plus, the gig comes with housing, and we hear the place is pre-furnished. But this job isn't just a great fit for us. It's a great fit for you too, America, and here's why. On tariffs. We're going to tariff the tariffs. If every 25% tariff has a 25% tariff on it, then by the properties of math, those tariffs become only 6.25%. Here's a brain teaser to help you understand our goals. If one tariff is coming at you at 6.8% and another tariff is heading towards you at 5.47%, at what point will Ted Cruz die? On immigration, amid mass deportation, Trump seems to have forgotten that America is a country of immigrants. We intend to remind him of this fact by deporting everybody. Then we'll host a singing competition to determine who's allowed back in. Inspired by The Voice, it will be called The Visa. And by the end, the only Americans left will be those with angelic voices. On Manifest Destiny, though Trump is into something with this whole annexing Greenland business, he's not thinking big enough. We're going to annex Greenland, Iceland, Finland, Thailand, New Zealand, and Disneyland. Once every other country is annexed, it will be impossible for anyone to be considered an immigrant because they'll all be U.S. citizens. On COVID, it feels like no one's talking about the disease that gave us a chill excuse to hang out with our moms. When elected, we're going to bring COVID back in a big way. The stimulus checks from COVID-27, COVID-28, A New Hope, COVID-29, Omicron Strikes Back, and COVID-30, Return of the Booster, will revamp our economy. On DOGE, headed by white Grinch Elon Musk, the Department of Government Efficiency has been spiraling out of control. Under our administration, we will demand that DOGE establish several DEI subcommittees and hire a 500-person HR team. The department will subsequently be forced to cut its own funding. On healthcare, we will not be doing this. On population growth, Trump wants to offer women $5,000 to have a child. We'll keep that policy, but add a policy by which women will receive $5,001 for every abortion received. This is what economists call an infinite money glitch. On culture, to ring in the next golden era of Hollywood, we will place a tariff on any animated films depicting foreign soil. Ratatouille, no thanks. Cars, all good. Mona, we'll get back to you on that one. On gifts from foreign countries, unlike the sitting president, we would never accept a jet from Qatar. We would, however, accept oil, lots and lots of oil. Our ultimate game goal is to be able to drench ourselves in oil and then wash ourselves off using more oil. With these 9 points, we intend to make not just the country proud, but our parents too. No more texts asking for laundry money, just campaign contributions. But we need your support. So this weekend, turn off your TVs and leave your babies home alone. Come vote for us. Thank you. Also from Random Notes, beam me up. Want a messiah complex? Just ask AI. Chatbots are giving some people prophetic delusions. Their loved ones are concerned. Less than a year after marrying a man she met at the beginning of the pandemic, Kat felt tension mounting between them. By 2022, her husband was using AI to compose text to me and analyze our relationship, says a 41-year-old education nonprofit worker. Previously, he had used A1 models for a coding camp he had quit without explanation. Then it seemed he was on his phone all the time, asking his A1 bot philosophical questions. Kat says, trying to train it to help me get to the truth. When the couple separated in August 2023, Kat blocked him on social media. But people kept reaching out about his strange and troubling posts, asking if he was in the throes of a mental crisis. When she finally got him to meet her this past February, he said that AI helped him recover a repressed memory of a babysitter trying to drown him, and that he learned of profound secrets, so mind-blowing I couldn't even imagine them. In his mind, he's an anomaly, Kat says. He's special, and he can save the world. After that meeting, she cut off contact. The whole thing feels like Black Mirror, she says. He was always into sci-fi, and there are times I wondered if he was viewing it through that lens. Kat was both horrified and relieved to learn that she is not alone in this predicament, as confirmed by a Reddit thread titled ChatGPT-induced psychosis. The original post came from a 27-year-old teacher who explained that her partner was convinced that the popular OpenAI model gives him the answers to the universe. Having read his chat logs, she found that AI was talking to him as if he was the next Messiah. The replies to her story were full of similar anecdotes about loved ones suddenly falling down rabbit holes of spiritual mana, supernatural delusion, and arcane prophecy, all of it sucked up by AI. Some came to believe they had been chosen for a sacred mission of revelation, others that they had conjured true sentence from the software. OpenAI did not return a request for comment about ChatGPT, apparently provoking religious fervor in select users. Earlier this year, however, it did roll back an update to GPT-4o, its current A1 model, which it said had been criticized as overly flattering or agreeable, often described as syncopatic. Before this change, an ex-user demonstrated how easy it is to get GPT-4o to validate statements like, "Today I realize I'm a prophet." Syncopancy in AI has been a problem for a long time, says Nate Sheridan, a fellow at the Center for A1 Safety. Since the human feedback used to fine-tune AI responses can encourage answers that prioritize a user's belief instead of facts. What's likely happening, he speculates, is that people with existing tendencies towards experiencing various psychological issues now have a human-level conversational partner with whom to co-experience their delusions. Aaron Westgate, a psychologist and researcher at the University of Florida, who studies social cognition and what makes certain thoughts more engaging than others, says the bot dialogues are not unlike talk therapy, which we know to be quite effective at helping people reframe their stories. Critically, though, AI does not have the person's best interests in mind, she says. A good therapist would not encourage a client to make sense of difficulties in their life by encouraging them to believe they have supernatural powers. Instead, they try to steer clients away from unhealthy narratives and toward healthier ones. ChatGPT has no constraints or concerns. Nevertheless, Westgate didn't find it surprising that some people are using ChatGPT in attempts to make sense of their lives or life events, and that some are following its output to dark places. Explanations are powerful, she concludes, even if they're wrong. And now from National Affairs, the great dismantling, making America backward again, president or mad king, how Donald Trump and MAGAnomics are destroying the economy and waging war on middle class and the poor, by Paul Krugman. If you weren't deeply afraid months ago of what a second Trump administration would mean, you weren't paying attention. The attack on democracy and the rule of law, the transformation of the land of the free into a nation where mass government agents kidnap people on the streets and opposition to the leader is criminalized was completely predictable. Even those who knew that bad things were coming, however, have been startled by the damage MAGA has done to our strengths, the speed, if you like, with which it has undermined American greatness. It was obvious that Donald Trump and company would pursue some bad economic policies, but few expected them to create a full-blown crisis in a matter of months. It was obvious that Trump's allies would degrade governance, but not that they would rapidly bring the whole apparatus of government to the point of collapse. It was predictable that MAGA would go after inconvenient research like the study of climate change, but not that it would move so decisively to destroy American science and intellectual endeavor in general. And much of the damage will be permanent. Even if MAGA is eventually driven from power and its policies are reversed, we may never go back to being the nation we were just a few months ago. Let's start with a brief portrait of who we used to be, the America that was. America at the end of the Biden years was in a sour mood, mostly because people were still angry about the surge in consumer prices as the economy recovered from COVID. Neither the bout of inflation nor the bad feelings, by the way, were unique to the United States. For example, the cumulative rise in consumer prices between the eve of COVID and January 2025 was almost exactly the same in the European Union as it was in the U.S. While, as the financial journalist John Berenmudic has said, 2024 elections were a graveyard of incumbents almost everywhere. Canada's Liberal Party was set to join that graveyard with an historic defeat until Trump came to its rescue. But if you look past the bad vibes, America at the beginning of this year was in good shape in many ways. Prices rose a lot between 2021 and 2023, but most workers' wages had outpaced inflation since the start of the pandemic, while the rate of inflation, the change in prices over the past year, had fallen dramatically from its peak in 2022. Furthermore, disinflation took place without the extended period of high unemployment many economists had said would accompany it. Taking a larger perspective, the performance of the U.S. economy in the 21st century has made it, as the economist put it, the envy of the world. Productivity and per capita income had grown much faster than in any other wealthy nation. With leading voices in Europe like Mario Draghi, the former president of the European Central Bank, calling for urgent efforts to narrow the growing dominance of U.S. companies in advanced technology, a gap that many attributed to inadequate investment, a lack of entrepreneurs willing to take risks, and the absence of high-tech clusters comparable to Silicon Valley. Part of that technology gap also probably had to do with the dominance of U.S. science and our superb system of higher education. Many non-economic indicators were looking good, too. Right-wingers like to portray a nation terrorized by immigrant crime, but the reality is that the COVID bump in crime rates quickly receded, and by 2024, America's homicide rate was near its lowest level over the past 65 years. New York had 2,262 murders in 1990. It had only 382 in 2024. Not everything was going well. Income inequality declined somewhat during the Biden years, with bigger wage gains at the bottom than at the top, but remained extreme. Deaths of despair, that is, deaths from suicide, alcohol abuse, and especially opioids, remained high. And one way in which America has performed poorly compared with our peers was our low and lagging life expectancy. If you look at a map of the electorate, low life expectancy and high mortality shows an obvious correlation with low rates of employment among men and large majorities for Trump. All in all, however, Trump took power in the nation despite its dark mood, which was doing well on many fronts. But he has moved quickly to fix that. Maganomics. While many voters expected Trump to bring back the prosperity over which he presided during most of his first term, whether or not he caused it, most economists who looked at his platform during the 2024 campaign gave it poor reviews. Three things in particular looked disturbing. First, Trump proposed large increases in tariff rates, much bigger than anything he did during his first term. These tariffs, according to basic economics, would cause inflation and reduce real incomes. Second, he called for large-scale deportations, which would be highly disruptive for industries like agriculture and construction that are highly dependent on foreign-born workers, some of them undocumented. Finally, he made it clear that he wanted to politicize the Federal Reserve the institution that both fights recessions and tries to keep inflation under control. The deportations we've seen so far have been brutal and illegal, but haven't yet involved a large number of workers. Trump has raged a lot against Jerome Powell, the Fed's chairman, but hasn't yet tried to take control. So these are still potential rather than ongoing threats to the economy. But the tariffs are here, belying the belief of many business supporters of Trump that he wouldn't go through with everything he talked about during the campaign. In practice, the Trump tariffs have been more extreme and, well, crazier than anything he suggested back then. I do mean extreme. America had fairly free trade with an average rate of 2.4% when Trump took office. Trump, however, imposed large tariffs, huge in fact. Imports from China temporarily faced a tariff of 145%. That rate has been provisionally reduced to 30%, but even after that climb down, the average tariff rate was 17.4%, the highest level of tariffs since 1934, not much lower than the rate after the infamous Smoot-Hawley tariff of 1930. All indications are that these tariffs will do large economic damage, much larger than pre-inauguration analysis predicted. Why will the damage be so severe? For one thing, there's a big difference between imposing 10 or 25% tariffs on a few imports and imposing 10% on everything and 30% on everything one of our major suppliers of both consumer goods and industrial imports produces. As I write this, West Coast ports are reporting a sharp drop in ships arriving from Asia. In fact, the latest report says that no container ships are departing China for America right now. The results of this collapse in trade could probably show up in a few weeks as inventories are exhausted. We'll soon see soaring prices, quite possibly empty shelves, and widespread layoffs, even bankruptcies, among businesses that depend on the flow of goods from abroad, including trucking companies, retailers, and quite a few manufacturers. Adding to this direct impact of tariffs is a large uncertainty Trump's tariff policy has created. If you've been following the story so far, you know that on April 2nd, insanely dubbed Liberation Day by the president, Trump imposed huge tariffs on countries and territories around the world, including islands inhabited only by penguins. Then a week later, he put those tariffs on a 90-day pause, replacing them with a new set of tariffs that were equally extreme on average, but quite different in detail. According to press reports, the big change came when two Trump cabinet members managed to corner him in his office while his trade czar was in another meeting. So who knows what tariff rates will be, say, 6 months or a year from now? And how are businesses supposed to plan in the face of such instability? If you're a company deciding whether to invest in, say, a factory in Mexico or a factory in the United States, you know that either investment could easily turn out to be a waste of money. A Mexican factory will be worthless if Trump keeps 25% tariffs in place. A higher cost U.S. facility will be worthless if he decides to take the tariffs off. It's worth noting that Trump's tariffs violate all our existing international trade agreements and have run into opposition in the courts. One of the main purposes of such agreements is precisely to help make future policy predictable. Now we have a U.S. government that treats solemn compacts with other countries as worthless pieces of paper. In this environment, the rational thing for many businesses and many consumers, too, is to sit on their hands, accumulating cash rather than making investments. The result is that we're facing a substantial risk of stagflation, rising prices and shortages because tariffs have cut off imports, and rising unemployment because erratic policy is deterring spending. And all this chaos is on Trump's head. The economy will be doing fine if he had left it alone. Demolishing government, waging war on the poor. Although the news media keep calling Trump a populist, it was clear before he regained power that his administration would follow a right-wing fiscal agenda. Big tax cuts for the rich, savage benefits cuts for the poor and working class. Even so, the budget bill that passed the House in May has been incredibly extreme. According to the Congressional Budget Office, it cuts almost $700 billion from Medicare, which will deny health care to millions. We may be talking about 15 million or more people losing insurance by this time this budget and other Trump policies go into effect. The budget also cuts close to $300 billion from SNAP, aka food stamps, which means that many Americans will go hungry. These cuts to social programs, the CBO estimates, reduce the purchasing power of lower-income U.S. households by around 4%. Some independent estimates are even bigger, and Trump's tariffs will also weigh heavily on working families, which will be hit hard by higher prices for clothing, food, and other essentials. It's a good guess that Americans in the bottom 10 or 20% of income distribution, who are already struggling, could find themselves on average 7% or more worse off, with many suffering even more than that. Yet despite these savage cuts at the bottom, taxes at the top are cut so much that the CBO estimates the budget will add $3.8 trillion to the deficit. If you don't believe the CBO's dismal deficit forecast, look at the bond market. Long-term interest rates on U.S. debt have soared to levels not seen in years, while the dollar's value against foreign currencies has plunged, suggesting that investors are losing faith in U.S. credibility, maybe even solvency. Beyond the viciousness and irresponsibility of its budget, the Trump administration has been destroying the ability of the government to carry out its most basic functions. When Trump created Elon Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, it was obvious that DOGE couldn't possibly deliver the huge cost savings Musk was promising. Of course there's waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government, as there isn't any large organization. But the great bulk of federal spending goes either to the social safety net or the military, and there is no reason to believe the Musk-engined, the young tech bros Musk was parachuting into agencies they didn't understand could have saved significant sums without creating chaos. The skeptics were right. DOGE's receipts listing purported savings have itemized only a tiny fraction of the sums Musk claimed he would deliver, and they're riddled with accounting errors. If DOGE has managed to cut overall spending at all, the amount has been too small to show up in budget data. DOGE has, however, created a lot of chaos. Stories keep surfacing of sudden dismissals of government workers who turn out to fulfill crucial functions, followed by desperate attempts to hire them back. Agency the public depends on, like Social Security, are fraying at the seams, with more and more tales of beneficiaries missing their checks, then finding it nearly impossible to get help. The monetary hit many Americans are about to take is one thing, but if you ask me, the psychological damage of this sabotage will go beyond the loss of money. Even if seniors, veterans, and others who depend on government aid eventually get what they've been promised, many will go through long periods of panic and frustration because they'll never know when or if they'll ever be helped. Maybe the federal government isn't a bloated, pointless bureaucracy. It is instead largely staffed by millions of good people who care about their jobs, often working for much lower salaries than they could make in the private sector. Subjecting them to arbitrary firings and treating them with contempt amounts to destroying a valuable public asset. As with Trump's tariffs, much of this damage will be irreversible. Even if DOGE is eventually shut down and the tech bros sent home in disgrace, how many of the dedicated civil servants we've lost will come back? How many young people will be willing to enter government service knowing what happened to their predecessors? The pretty good federal government we had just 4 months ago has been degraded, and it may take months to restore it, if not decades. The war on knowledge. America leads the world in science and intellectual inquiry of all kinds, or it did a few months ago. It's hard to overstate the devastation Trump has wrought since then. I don't know how many people realize the extent to which the Trump administration has already brought scientific research in America to a screeching halt. The 2026 budget proposal released by the administration would cut funding for the National Institutes of Health by 40% and funding for the National Science Foundation by more than half. But support for research has already dried up well in advance of next fiscal year. On April 30th, NSF staffers were instructed to stop awarding all funding actions until further notice. This doesn't just mean no new grants. It means no disbursement of increments of money on existing grants. Worse, the NIH appears to be ghosting grantees, not formally canceling their grants, but simply failing to send the promised funds. Nor is a war on science just about money. Every way you look, there's a push to shut down any research that MAGA-types think is woke or touches on DEI. This doesn't have to mean, say, gender studies. It could mean any study that might provide evidence for climate change or suggest that vaccines work and doesn't cause autism. This is a frontal assault on intellectual inquiry of any kind. Here, too, much of the damage is likely to be permanent. Even if a future administration were to restore funding and end the campaign against perceived wokeness, who will want to begin a major research project in a nation that behaves this way? How many leading scientists or talented foreign students will want to accept positions at U.S. universities, knowing they're one election away from persecution, maybe even arrest? As far as science is concerned, the American century may well be over. Crypto's new gilded age. One of the more surprising developments deserves mention, the Trumpian boosting and exploitation of cryptocurrency. It may soon be hard to believe, but Bitcoin is an elderly idea as informational technologies go. It was created in 2008, which makes it almost as old as the iPhone. In all the years since, the vast legions of cryptocurrency salesmen have failed to find any real economic role for their products. Most legitimate businesses don't accept payment in crypto. Even in countries like El Salvador, they have spent large sums trying to promote the digital currency. But illegitimate business, where being able to transfer large sums that legal authorities can't track, is another matter. Cryptocurrency, especially stable coins like Tether, have come to play a huge role in criminal activity, especially in blackmail and extortion. Now crypto has found an even more remarkable use, bribery, with useless Trump and Melania coins being used to transfer billions to the president and his family, likely in return for influence. The president even threw a party for crypto enthusiasts, charging them $1 million for the pleasure of his company. It all makes the corruption of the Gilded Age look petty and quaint. Next, we turn to the cover story. Wild for Sabrina, Sabrina Carpenter. The world can't seem to get enough of her joke-cracking pop, and she's just warming up. Put your arms in and get your chest below the water. Just breathe in and out, super slowly. You're doing great. Like, damn, we got 20 seconds left. Want to keep going? I'm in the private suite of a swanky spa in central London one morning in early March, and one of the world's biggest pop stars is guiding me through a cold plunge. Across from me, Sabrina Carpenter is shoulders deep in a cylindrical wooden ice bath of her own, braving 4 degrees Celsius in a baby blue lace bikini. When our 3 minutes are up, the 26-year-old rises out of the frigid water. We're done, she excitedly announces. Wow, already you're like, I'm a new woman. As she famously sang in her inescapable hit, Espresso, Carpenter works late because she's a singer, but she's also an early riser. It's 9 a.m, the morning after the first of 2 sold-out shows at the O2 Arena. Several celebrities were in attendance last night, including Harry Styles, Hugh Grant, Janet Jackson, gloated Carpenter notes, Spice Girls' Emma Bunton, this show's honorary guest for Juno, during which Carpenter arrests someone in fuzzy pink handcuffs, and James Corden, who brought his children backstage to meet Carpenter. Though it wasn't Carpenter's first time playing the O2, She opened for British boys band The Vamps there in 2017 and kicked off the Brit Awards just days ago with a sizzling performance that featured the Royal Guard. Last night felt like her first official time. Or as Carpenter simply thought to herself, I run this bitch tonight. You can trace all this back to last year's Short and Sweet, the cheeky masterpiece that transformed Carpenter from a former Disney child star who made music to a certified pop superstar. She's a red-hot cultural supernova who mastered the art of humorous heartbreak, transforming her love losses into major wins. Her man might turn out to be a wellness-obsessed drag who jacks off to lyrics by Leonard Cohen, and she may find the dating game tough since the Lord neglected to grant her a gay awakening. But Carpenter is not just in on the joke, she's the one cracking them. Plenty of stars can craft catchy, clever love songs with glassy hooks, but Carpenter's ship-witted lines are on another level. She's as intelligent as someone can possibly be, which is why she's so funny, says her producer, Jack Antonoff. When she says something incredibly profound and then chucks it away with a joke, it almost hits deeper. You go back, the Beatles would have the most beautiful love songs on earth, and then something that sounds like a cartoon that John or Paul made up in their head. Some of the best songs ever, and these really funny things, live hand in hand. It's something I've personally been yearning for, and I think other people have been too. Short and Sweet earned Carpenter 6 Grammy nominations, including nods in the big 4 categories, and one for Best Pop Vocal Album, and second, Best Pop Solo Performance for Espresso. She appeared as a musical guest on Saturday Night Live last May, and has returned to the show twice more, duetting with Paul Simon on Homeward Bound to kick off the 50th anniversary special earlier this year. He trusted me a lot with that, she notes, because I could have fucked that up. And making a cameo during host Quinita Brunson's monologue in May. Along the way, Carpenter got to collaborate with another legend, Dolly Parton, who joined Carpenter on Please, Please, Please from the deluxe version of Short and Sweet. It felt like I was looking in a weird mirror into the future, Carpenter says of her hero, who is also a 5-foot-tall blonde with serious pipes. Our voices are very similar, Dolly Parton tells me. I can't tell them sometimes which part's her and which part is me, and we look like relatives. She looks like she could be my little sister. We're little women doing big things. Those things are going to even get bigger this year when Carpenter releases the follow-up to Short and Sweet. She recently dropped the new single, Man Child, a spicy kiss-off to an ex. Asked which ex it's about, she replies, it's about your dad. Like several of the Short and Sweet songs, Carpenter co-wrote it with Antonoff and Amy Allen. It's easily my favorite song we've ever done together, Antonoff says. The things we did on the last album, things that people really loved, were just the start of places we wanted to take it. It's like, oh, you like that? Well, just you wait. A child actor who got her start on the Disney spinoff Girl Meets World, Carpenter released her debut album, Eyes Wide Open, in 2015. It's taken her 10 years, but she always knows her time would come, that the Super Trooper lights would find her. I do feel like the timing wasn't a coincidence, she says, because I always felt a really weird relationship with the universe, and I always felt like it was going to work out. But I also feel at the same time, how the fuck did all that happen? I don't want to get too cocky. I've been here for 10 years, but also 10 minutes. When Carpenter first meets me at Rebase, the spa in the chic neighborhood of Marylebone, she's wearing her own merchandise, a white tee with a lingerie dress printed on it, the lacy undergarment, a quintessential component of the Short and Sweet aesthetic. She's cozied up in a black Aritzia coat, matching black Uggs, and a leopard print scarf blanketing her blonde hair. When I tell her, Espresso, turns a year old in the near future, her eyes widen in disbelief. "That shit's still on some chart somewhere," she says of the mega hit. "It's not leaving the public consciousness anytime soon either." Just the other day, Carpenter called for room service at her hotel, asking for a shot of her famed drink. "The woman just started cracking up," Carpenter says. "I was like, how do you know the sound of my voice? Do you know that it's me? This is so strange." Ironically, Carpenter drinks very little coffee, preferring yerba mate. "Tap in," she tells me, "it's everything." The South American herbal tea isn't present inside the Rebay suite, but the space has every other wellness beverage you can think of, including packets of colostrum, collagen, and electrolytes. A nearby table contains several bottles of liquids in a symmetrical pattern, from coconut water to turmeric juice to kombucha. Carpenter holds up the shot of an energy drink labeled Ketone IQ. "I thought," she said, "ketamine." She says, "I like, wow." It's an unusual move these days to release a new album while still tearing behind the one before. But Carpenter is learning to do what she wants and to tune out the rest. "If I really wanted to, I could have stretched out Short and Sweet much, much longer," she says. "But I'm at that point in my life where I'm like, wait a second, there's no rules. If I'm inspired to write and make something new, I would rather just do that. Why would I wait 3 years just for the sake of waiting 3 years? It's all about what feels right. I'm learning to listen to that a lot more instead of what is perceived as a right or wrong move." At least for right now, with a new album under wraps, she doesn't have to think about others' opinions. "I'm living in the glory of no one hearing it or knowing about it, and so I cannot care," Carpenter says. "I cannot give a fuck about it because I'm just so excited." It's our final round in the cold plunge, and it's a brutal one. We decide to cap it at a minute, which seems like an eternity. "I'm really contemplating my life," Carpenter says. She peers over at me, her hair tucked away in a tortoise claw clip, and tries to distract herself. "Do you know any good pubs in London?" Henshaw kicks off with Carpenter using two words, a loaded "oh, bye." It's short, similar to the Short and Sweet deluxe gem Busy Woman, which opens with a playful "oh, hey," only there's a message behind this particular intro. "It's literally like previously on," Carpenter explained. "It's been a second since we said hi, and there's a sense of we're back in it. It's a deep breath and an eye roll and back in the story," which I think is. But before she can reveal the story, Carpenter stops herself. "I'm always thinking about life and my music like it's a movie," she says, which is such a 25-year-old thing to say. She turned 26 on May 11th. "But I really never felt like more of a main character in a coming-of-age movie than when I listened to the song, and that's how I wanted the video to feel." Carpenter's songs are usually born out of two scenarios: intentional writing sessions or spontaneous bursts of creativity that could happen anywhere or anytime, where she crafts a song in a moment of catharsis. "That was one of those times, which is why it feels more special," she says. "If I'm not in the studio right now writing something, then I'm going to die." Carpenter sees songwriting as a way to freeze her feelings in time. "I need to make sense of what I'm feeling and what I'm going through to put it down on paper." She means that literally. While Carpenter uses the Notes app on her phone to write, like us civilians, she's currently running out of iCloud storage, she employs a notebook a friend gifted her titled Pop Hits, Sabrina Carpenter. It's where she writes wrote most of Short and Sweet. "I never thought I'd be that bitch writing it down on paper," she jokes. Carpenter didn't consciously set out to make another album. After Short and Sweet wrapped, she continued writing and working with Antoff and Allen with no expectations. She describes the process as slow and steady. They have to weed out several bad songs to find one good one, but there was little frustration. Far from it, actually. Carpenter was absolutely psyched. "I really just been making things, excited about them, and then continuing forth," she says. "Not to be dramatic, but what can I do while my legs still work? I'm limber. Let's use it. My brain is sharp. Let's write it. I try not to get sad about the fact that nothing lasts forever, but generally it's such a beautiful time right now. I want to soak it up and keep making things while I'm feeling this way. Carpenter is a student of pop, and when looking back at her favorite artists' discographies, from Parton to Linda Ronstadt, she made a crucial observation, one that informed her decision to follow up Short and Sweet so quickly. They would release a album, 10-song album every year. They would release a 10-song album every year, she says. I'm like, why did we stop doing that? Writers write, they make music, and they release music. I understand the beauty of disappearing. My last two albums both took 2.5 years to make, and they just needed to. I just think everything, every project is different. It just has to feel right. Most artists would buckle under the pressure of having to follow up on an album that dream come true their whole lives. But it only fueled Carpenter to keep creating. The new album wasn't written from a place of, how do I one-up myself, or how do I recreate myself, she says. Short and Sweet has this magical gift. It fed me, and it fed a lot of other people in the world. It felt true to me, and it felt authentic to do a lot of other people. It's rare that those line up ever, let alone more than once. It unlocked my brain to know more, myself more and more. Antoff felt a new era started the minute Manchild was born, completely right before the new year, along with two other tracks they knocked out. When I heard those three, that was the moment when I was like, oh my God, he says, you could imagine the entire album from that point because the songs had such identity. I find a lot of this album to be some of the most honest work I've ever done. There's something really celebratory about it, but most of the lyrical content is about disappointments in relationships and all the different shapes it takes. I think it's a celebration of those who let you down. In between cold plunges, we sit in the Sweet's wood-paneled sauna as Carpenter plays music like a Bluetooth speaker, Sam Cooke's Nothing Can Change This Love, Stevie Wonder's My Sharia Moore, Joan Baez's cover of Bob Dylan, It Ain't Me, Babe, and Fleetwood Mac's As Long As You Follow. She's a Christine girl, citing the 1974 deep cut Prove Your Love as her favorite Mac song. The rebase employee, a lanky fellow named Rico, brings us a snowball infused with peppermint oil. He's my king, Carpenter tells me as he exits. I feel like he would take such good care of me in my life. Carpenter loves essential oils and uses a particular blend of them, lavender, geranium, and chamomile, when she's on her period. I'm really going to get it today or tomorrow, which sucks, she says. Playing shows where you're in your, you know, do you know about the luteal phase, she asks, casually referring to the post-ovulating, pre-menstruating portion of the cycle. I'm very into the luteal phase right now. I've been like, oh, that's why I'm ugly for 10 days of the month. Carpenter says her ex has gotten her into cold plunging. I really got introduced to this shit by boys that I've dated, I've made fun of, or for doing it, she explains. She references the Short and Sweet cut, Dumb and Poetic, in which she disses a wellness bro who ingests mushrooms, reads self-help books, and meditates. It's the one with the line about Leonard Cohen, which caused a stir online, and Carpenter, with the help of her sister and creative partner Sarah, even includes a 1966 Cohen TV interview to screen when she performs the song on tour. It's very that, to be honest, she says of her foray into contrast therapy. I would always make fun of it, being like, oh, the cold shower isn't going to fix your mental health. You need to actually maybe see a therapist. But then I tried it and I was like, you know what? There's a little something to it. Mentally, it's not getting my life together, but it's definitely helping my body heal. And it's helping me have a little more clarity and energy. Unfortunately, it's a cult, but I'm here for it. She adds, I have a type, I guess. As the Bee Gees' Emotion plays in the sauna, Carpenter mentions she rewatched Saturday Night Fever the other night. My favorite fun fact I learned is that four of their biggest hits were written for the movie, she says. Isn't that insane? They just locked in so hard. Sweating inside the chamber as our eyes started to burn from the peppermint, we touch on the dark underbelly of Saturday Night Fever. That beneath the euphoric music and sweaty dance floors, There's a lot of cringeworthy scenes of rape, suicide, and racism. Also, teens openly having sex in vehicles. They all just casually fucked in front of each other, Carpenter says. I was like, did people used to do that? Because I was not alive, and now, oh my God, privacy is everything. They're just hanging out in cars, fucking in front of their friends. If my friends were fucking in the corner, I would be so deeply offended and scared. But it was such a different time. When it comes to 70s music, however, nothing comes close to how Carpenter feels about ABBA. She is such a super fan that she named her two British short-haired cats, Benny and Borns, after Benny Andersson and Borns Ovakus. And she regularly covers Swedish pop legends during the slumber party portion of her set. It's such a kismet artist for the show, she says. I don't know if there's any other artist in the world who makes me so happy. They just understand how to make fun music without it feeling cheesy or corny. Even when it does, you're into it because they just had to sell it. The band's digital residency, ABBA Voyage, even inspired her outfits on the Short and Sweet tour, particularly the hazy light blue costume that Agnetha Flixkos wears. If this seems excessive to you, just know that Carpenter nearly went a step further in her fandom. I almost did a glow-in-the-dark look because they had light-up outfits in their show, and I was like, you know what? It's a lot easier to do this when you're a hologram. And that's it for Sabrina Carpenter, and that's it for Rolling Stone. Thank you for listening. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.